Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Long Story Short, the podcast about storytelling and connection, where we interview marketers and entrepreneurs to hear the stories they tell about their brands. I'm Jeff.
And I'm Sophia. This is a podcast by humans for humans who also happen to be marketers. On this week's show, our guest is Kyle Lacey.
Kyle brings over 13 years of experience in marketing with a slice of revenue. He is currently the chief marketing officer at Lessonly. Prior to joining Lessonly, Kyle held senior positions at OpenView, Salesforce, and ExactTarget. He is the author of three books, Twitter Marketing for Dummies, Branding Yourself, and Social CRM for Dummies. He loves monotone and hates onions.
You are in for a real treat this week as we gain insight into Lessonly, a company with a fascinating approach to work and broader culture. And we get to talk to the guy that helps make it all happen and brings his own unique perspective to the role as their CMO.
Yeah, we had a great discussion with Kyle. I loved his perspective on holding marketing accountable to revenue without losing sight of building the brand. So without further ado, please enjoy our conversation with Kyle Lacey. Hi, Kyle. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. So I want to start with where you are today. And so can you give us a sense of, you know, what your world looks like, as the CMO of Lessonly?
In today's world, in the pandemic, a lot of it is spent thinking about how to make sure the team feels listened to and feels heard and feels normal for empathy. I spend a lot of time just thinking about empathy in general. So I'm going to put it in thirds. One third is empathy. One third is thinking about what we're going to do a year from now. And the other third is hiring. So it's a lot of strategic direction, budgeting, meetings, a lot of Zoom calls, and just building the team out, making sure we're structured to win in the next year.
So one thing we always like to hear after getting an idea of what your present is like is how you got to where you are right now. So we're very interested in what the most impactful experiences for you were throughout your professional journey that have now led to your present position as CMO at Lessonly.
Yeah, there's one big one that happened. So I graduated college in 2006, and after college, spent some time in a local agency in Indianapolis where I'm from and live, and then started an agency. Spent that doing that for 5 years. And as it was burning to the ground, which is a completely different podcast that we could talk about some other time, I had reached out to a guy that I had met at a 40 under 40 event. So, you know, every town has the business journal. Mm-hmm. I had gotten 40 under 40. I'm not sure who my partners paid, but at like 24 years old. And I had met Scott Dorsey at one of these parties. And Scott Dorsey, at the time, had started ExactTarget. He was the CEO of ExactTarget. And I just needed somebody to talk to about my business. I had talked to him for maybe 30 seconds at this event. I emailed him and said, hey, I just need help. Will you talk to me? And he spent 45 minutes on the phone one night on his drive home talking to some kid that he met for 30 seconds at an event about how I was messing up my entire business and screwing up my partners and all this crap, right? And that moment has shaped my entire career to us sitting here today, because when I knew that the business wasn't going to work, I joined ExactTarget because ExactTarget was a customer of mine. And after ExactTarget was bought by Salesforce, Scott encouraged me to go join OpenView, where the founder of OpenView was an original investor in Scott at ExactTarget. And then Scott's on the board at Lessonly. And Lessonly is also a portfolio company of OpenView. So I can pretty much tie my most impactful moments of my career, whether that was, you know, the IPO, the acquisition by Salesforce, the moving to Boston and working at a venture capital firm, and then moving back to Indy because of Scott Dorsey, because he is usually the person that I will reach out to when I feel like there's an inflection point that's about to happen in my career. And I think I could not understate the importance of finding somebody that helps you with that, whether that's a mentor or somebody that you've met. So for me, it was my first taste of software was at a massive software company at Exact Target. I think we hired 500 people the year I joined. And then now at Lessonly, where, you know, we just clipped 220 people, where, you know, I've been there for four years now. That was a really long answer, but that's
That's great. So I want to follow up on one thing you mentioned, because I think that's such an important theme, and I have, you know, sort of a similar story. And as you're saying that, obviously, you know, sort of my mentor pops in my mind. But I think one thing that I always think about is you know, maybe as a society, we're probably not as forthcoming or as open and sort of searching out and seeking out those mentors and sort of. And again, not saying, hey, will you be my mentor? And will you play this really important part of my life over the next, you know, 20 years or so? But just generally in terms of, you know, reaching out and sort of asking for help, right, and guidance. And you know, any tips you have in terms of, you know, sort of just, hey, you know, like, what's the worst that can happen? Or, you know, like, what would you say to somebody who is in that kind of position where they're sort of, you know, sort of, I don't want to say rudderless or whatever, but they could use some help from somebody who's been there?
Actually make the ask. And then don't make it so formal. I don't think I've ever uttered the word mentor to Scott, and I don't think he would say he is a mentor, but he has just been that impactful in my life. And it's just random, honestly. But usually what happens is that somebody will reach out to, let's say me, let's just use me as an example. Somebody, a new sales leader, new marketing leader reaches out to me, asks if I'm interested in mentorship. And maybe I don't respond because we're all busy. We have lives. Usually what happens is that they don't ever follow back up.
Right.
So you have to make the ask, and then you have to pursue the ask, or because there's a lot of people who ask for that stuff all the time. And usually the best mentorships are fluid and unseen and not called out. I don't have a mentor right now. I just have people that I will email if I have a problem, and people that I touch base with, you know, once a month or once every other month.
I think one of the things with asking for help, though, is in addition to just having the ability to make the ask, you have to actually have an understanding of what you need and what you're asking of the person. And I think, you know, vocalizing your goals or where you're hoping to get from this conversation is also really hard, in addition to just saying, hey, I need help.
Yeah. And I mean, if you were to ask me to figure out what I need from a mentor, I'm not sure I could tell you, because my needs change pretty dramatically, depending on the weather. Right. So, you know, the best thing you can do is not think about mentorship, but to think about how you build a community of peers that will help you. And that's it. And I am lucky that I have done that since I left college, because my father threw me into a networking event when I was like a sophomore in college. And can you imagine how awkward I was at a networking event with like this was true networking. This was like insurance agents and real estate agents and business cards and name tags. But because of that, that's what I do. And I make it a priority to make sure that I'm constantly cultivating that community, because I don't ever want to use a resume to get a job, ever. And if you want to pursue a career, you should be thinking the same thing. And then what are the things you have to do in order to make that a reality?
So we know something else in addition to having people who have helped you is you really try in your leadership approach to do that as well and put that out. And more specifically, we know you've described yourself as a serving leader. And so we want to know a little bit more about what this means to you and why it is so central to your approach.
I think it has to do with how I approach personal life as well. You know, what's the book called? The Five Love Languages, or whatever the hell that book's called. You know, having one of mine is I give. I have to give. And if I give and I don't have recognition of that gift, then I feel worse, right? So for me, being a servant leader, it's mostly me giving back. The other side of that is the empathetic side of being a servant leader, which I have zero of. So I've had to work on that. And building empathy, especially this past year. But for me, it's just, I gain energy from when I give to people, whether that's a gift card or it's helping somebody, or like, that's where I get my energy.
That's really powerful. And that certainly resonates with me as well. As you're saying, I can, you know, kind of feel I'm wired very similarly.
There's a great book by Adam Grant called Give and Take. Highly recommend it. I'm reading it for a second time as part of our like marketing leadership group that we do at Lessonly. I'm definitely in the middle of the give and take. Like,
yep. I love that. So want to dig in a little bit to, you know, sort of your world at Lessonly a little bit. And what's the, you know, just for sort of our listeners out there, what's the brand story that you tell today for Lessonly?
We have a llama. His name's Ollie. Actually, Ollie exists in real life. We sponsor a llama in upstate New York. And I'm happy to announce that Ollie Llama actually had a baby as well. So we are also sponsoring Ollie Llama's son.
Wow.
I don't know the gender, but but so Ollie will join sales calls. He'll join our all team events, and he's got like a Lessonly blanket and stuff that he puts on and all that stuff. But anyway, so our brand, the brand's evolved a little bit, but I have to give a lot of credit to Max and Connor. Max is the CEO. Connor's our president. They are the first two people. They started the company, basically. It has been very easy for me to build a storyline around our mission statement because it's so powerful. You know, we help people do better work so they can live better lives. I mean, that's like it's a softball for a brand marketer because you can do, there's so much stories and visual elements that you can pull off of this idea of do better work. So for us, it was doubling down on the mission statement. And now it's evolving into more category creation for us, you know, sales enablement, customer service enablement, sales readiness, like things that our product does. So the mission statement and the values are so human first, like share before we're ready, have difficult conversations. Like that's not a normal value statement that you usually hear from a company. So for us, the brand's built around our values and our mission. And then outside of that, it's built off of our community and it's our employees. It's our ability to scale our culture in a way that's meaningful because those values are central to what we do and how we build out our teams. And then it's also our customers. And I will always believe that a large portion of a brand is the customer. And do you surprise and delight your customers as much as possible? We saw it at Exact Target where we had a thing called Orange Culture, which the brand was orange and you were onboarded and it was everything. Like everything was orange, absolutely everything. And our customers started adopting the Orange Culture at their places of work as well. When that happens, you know you've won, in my opinion, because you know whether it's we have a golden llama that we send out to people so they can give to their employees to celebrate them. It's just how do you scale culture, and when you scale culture and surprise and delight customers, your brand will go with it as well as your company when it comes to, because we're all in the revenue business here. Like it's not just brand everywhere, right? You know, you actually have to drive revenue and grow companies. But I think brand's a huge component of that.
So let me, you know, there's so many different places kind of want to go off of that.
Yeah, that was all over the place. Sorry.
No. But again, these are all things that I think are sort of fruitful roads. And so from a data geek, one thing that you just mentioned is, you know, how direct you are in referring to what your team does is revenue marketing and revenue enablement. I've heard you use that term as well. And something that may get mixed reactions from B2B marketers, you know, that you don't believe in any kind of marketing influence metric. And so can you talk about your stance on that?
Marketing should influence 100% of revenue. So why measure it? Right. Unless you're not. So for me... I am at the core a brand marketer, but my team could not do what we're doing unless we were driving revenue. So marketers, B2B marketers should think like B2C e-commerce marketers. And if B2C e-commerce marketers do not drive revenue at cart, then they're not going to have a job. And so B2B marketers should strive to at least drive as much top of funnel revenue creation as possible. At Lessonly, in our commercial segment, we do direct sourced. Like if the outbound SDR sets a meeting, great. It's counted towards marketing and marketing sourcing. Enterprise is a little bit different because it's more pipe gen.
Right.
So that's also evolving as we grow as a company. But for me, revenue gives you a seat at the table. Brand does not.
Yep.
But you need brand to win. So for us, it's 75% of our time, headcount budget, and program spend goes towards revenue. How is it creating demand? And then 25% of it goes into a black hole that we don't measure. And that's our brand budget. And we don't measure it because if you task a creative team to build something that's ROI focused, they will not be as creative as they could be. And so for me, you know, I don't care. Like we did a board game. Like we built a board game from scratch for direct mail. I have no idea whether it drove revenue. I do know that customers play it. Great. You know, we don't know if the Golden Llama drove revenue. I do know that there's tons of pictures on the internet of people giving Golden Llamas to people. You don't have to measure everything, but the only way I can say that is because we source revenue.
Yeah, I think you're so right. And I think what a lot of B2B marketers end up is in sort of that gray area where they're sort of trying to measure everything equally, having a difficult time doing it. But I really love the concept of knowing, you know, very intentionally that that you're going to take a portion of your spend and intentionally not measure it, or know that it's not going to be measurable at the end of the day. And hopefully the goal is that it's going to be the rising tide that lifts all boats.
Yeah. And we can do, we're a venture backed software company. EBITDA is not our goal here.
Right.
Our goal
right.
is growth.
Right.
So I can, it's easy for me to say that. And I'm sure there's people on here that are running profitable companies that are like, this guy's crazy, but you can do it as well. As long as you're managing cash appropriately. But if you do not invest in brand, you're going to look like everybody else. And right now in the software world, all we're doing is feature wars right now.
Right.
And the people who are going to win are the people who can tell a better story, as long as your product can keep up with it.
That's exactly right. And I've said that, you know, one of the biggest unlocks to me that I feel that is we're just sort of late on at this point is, to me, all B2B should really be copying B2C, right? At the end of the day, you're still selling to people. And frankly, I've always said that they're about 10 years behind. And really, that's ultimately working with B2B marketers is just an effort in how quickly can you get them to sort of adopt a lot of the tactics that B2C has been using for years.
Yeah. And that's going to change pretty dramatically with product-led growth as a strategy, because now the Typeforms, the Calendlys, the MailChimps of the world are consumer, are B2C. Like you have growth marketers because it's about the experience. B2B in the past, it wasn't, right? I mean, one of the largest B2B software companies is Salesforce.
Right.
Like it's not the experience, right? I mean, they've built that thing on brand. So now that we have product led, my goal is that B2C is looking to B2B at some point. I think Adobe is kicking ass right now in that regard. Excuse my French. But you know, that's my goal, is that I want to influence the consumer marketer, not the other way around.
So something else that really interests me is the company culture that you brought up within Lessonly. And every great story has to start with, so there was a llama, right? Like that's a perfect way to build up a company.
And the llama had a baby.
Yes.
The llama had a baby, which is recent.
But wait, there's more. So it's great. I love it. And I'm really interested to hear a little bit more, especially in your 4 years that you've been with Lessonly and how they've had to grow and you've had to scale that company culture. Could you tell us just a little bit more about what makes Lessonly so special?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a bunch of things. You know, I've already talked about the values and the mission and the fact that those values are easily transferable from person to person because they make sense, right? They're not like drive growth or blah, blah, blah. It's like share before ready. Yeah, we get it, right? So that's number one. And then with that, how do you create something that allows the culture to scale as you hire more people and go remote? And for us, it was the book that our CEO wrote 2 years ago called Do Better Work. And it's all the values in stories in the book. It's an hour and a half read. You can check it out on Amazon if you want. Go buy it. You can read about the Less Than Culture. We give every new employee a book. We give our customers this book, right? So when you have something that's easy to consume and you're constantly talking about it, it's easy to scale culture in that way. And we have seen that at Less Than over the past 6 months where we've started hiring more remote people. Like the majority of our people were in Indianapolis as of, you know, September of 2020, and now we're hiring all over the country, right? But we haven't really seen a degradation of the culture by bringing in people that haven't stepped foot in the office, which is fascinating to me. And, you know, we're having a lot of conversations about it and nothing really is bubbling up. It's like people are bought in. They're just bought in when they walk in the door. So for us, it is that book. We have another one coming out in May. That's basically our CEO writes a bi-weekly email that has nothing to do with software. It's just everything about his thoughts on life and leadership. And that's a huge culture driver too. You know, we send out that email and get 25 responses back from customers talking about their kids and their personal life and how this impacted their discussion with a teammate. You cannot pay for that. You can't pay for that. So for us, it is, how do you balance the values of empathy and human first with being aggressive as well as a software company that has to grow? And, you know, we're learning through that, but that's, and then Ollie sets the tone for our voice as a brand. And we've just been lucky that the people that we've hired continue that voice in a way that's not a robot. It's not robotic.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's not robotic also because you said it's a human voice, you know, and that plays into all of the different brand decisions. And, you know, something that we always say is that, like, you're people first. And so if people aren't feeling that human connection, they're not going to feel connected to the brand or anything else that the brand is doing, both internally and on an external
face. I will say one warning, you could definitely over-index too much on the brand side and forget that you are a software company delivering results.
Yep.
And we did that. I think we spent too much time trying to figure out how to truly tell the story in a way that's human first and forget business outcomes. Make sure you are also having those conversations about what the business outcomes are that are happening for your customers, not just, hey, how are you doing? Because we are now playing a little bit of catch up for Lessonly to say, all right, here are the business outcomes as well as our human first mentality as a company.
Yep. I mean, something that really interests me, A, is everything's a balancing act, right? And so we always have to have both ends of the equation being met. But when you are speaking human, one interesting business outcome is, like, people like to understand what they're doing, right? Yeah. And a lot of times I think speaking a human makes things make more sense than would be if you're trying to use these generalized, maybe overhyped terms, and then no one's really understanding and then no one's productive because they're all confused, or no one buys your product because they don't get it. So
yeah, right. And they want to be successful in their job, and they're buying your software because you're going to help them be successful. So never forget that. You know, you can learn all you want about Mary in sales enablement and Mary's home life and how, and, you know, all the stuff that goes around persona development. But if you don't understand the outcome, it makes it difficult to grow.
Yeah, definitely. So on the train of people and compassion and empathy and all that fun stuff, you mentioned that it is something that you've had to work to develop on that empathetic leadership side, and something that I'm really interested in because we've heard from so many people we've had on the value of empathetic leadership. I think everyone sort of bought in, understands that that's an important thing to consider, but not everyone talks about how to actually develop that and the tactical side of it. And so I'm really interested, as someone who's had to work on that, I think it's really important for our listeners to hear maybe any tips or tricks that you've had in building that muscle.
Listening. That's it for me, honestly. I wish it was a little bit more built out than that. But, you know, for me, it is making sure that if I'm having a 30-minute one-on-one with an SDR or demand gen manager or our head of experience marketing, that I'm actually listening to them. Because I think that you can be tactical all day long. And this is so hard for me. This is so, like, if you had any of my direct reports on the call, they will be like, yes, he does not do this well. I'm very tactical and I want to get stuff done and I want to help. But the listening portion of how are they doing? Like, how are you doing? Ask that and listen. And usually honestly, you'll hear things that you didn't know.
I think it's almost better that it's a simple answer. You know, I think so many people have this idea of, oh my gosh, there's all this intricacy that comes behind it. And that's what scares people, right? And so a simple, all you got to do is listen. Like, that's almost more helpful to hear. So
forgive yourself when you don't do it well. I've had to learn that too. You know, if I hear somebody struggling with something and I take a note down to make sure I follow up and for some reason I forget, like, just forgive yourself and move on and just make sure you try better next time. Because everybody is trying. We're all trying.
Including yourself, right? Treat yourself the way you know, give yourself the same latitude you would give to them.
Yep, absolutely. And that's one of the core things that Max, our CEO, talked about all of last year. It was, you can spend all day long being empathetic towards people, but if you do not give yourself the same love and support that you are giving everyone else, you are going to burn just like you would if you were ignoring everybody. So it's very, 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 very important. Mental health in general.
It could not agree more. Something that we certainly talk about a ton here. One thing actually, just because it literally happened yesterday, I was listening to a story of somebody was on social media and they were saying exactly that. And it was something around how you develop empathy. And it was, you know, we all find ourselves in that situation where someone's telling you a story and immediately the first thing in your mind is to go to a comparable story that you can't wait to tell as soon as they're done. And it's just, you know what, just some of the time, not all the time, just take a breath, let them share that story and listen, right? And exactly as you're saying, and don't just be so excited to jump in because you have a better story that's going to top them.
Or you want to solve their problem.
That's right.
One thing I highly recommend is try to create awkward silence. Just try it. Next time you're on a one-on-one, just let them talk until they're done and then sit there for a couple seconds and have it be really awkward. Because then you know that you listened and you weren't trying to solve the problem or come up with a solution or whatever. Like, just let's, and then, you know, let them talk first.
That's so powerful. So just to get a tiny bit tactical, as an experienced marketer, we like to ask our guests, you know, is there a piece of marketing gold, sort of a tactic that you've used successfully, and maybe it's something that's off the beaten path a little bit, that you've used successfully that you'd recommend to other marketers?
Direct mail. And I don't mean a t-shirt and a Yeti. Cool. You know, I don't need any more. I don't need any more t-shirts. I don't need any more stickers. I don't need another... looking around, I've got like 40 in here. I don't need another notebook or pen. Like, spend some time thinking about the experience. And when I open that box or whatever you send it in, surprise me, right? So for us, it's been direct mail. It has been our Golden Llama campaign. It was our, at the time, our director of marketing, Ben Battaglia, his idea where, you know, we give a Golden Llama quarterly to an employee that delivered the values. And we have a wall in our office of all the Gold Llama award winners. And he said, let's give it to customers. Like, let's send it in the mail and say, have a note card that says, give this to your employee that's, living out your values best way possible. It was way more eloquent than that on the note card, but I'm not a copywriter. And we've sent, I mean, I'm going to die young because I spray painted like 2,000 of these like 3-inch llama, like plastic llama. There's some company in Michigan that we made their year of 2 years ago because we ordered thousands of these little 3-inch llamas. And they're like, who the hell? Every time I called in, they're like, what are you doing with all these llamas? I'm like, well, we're spray painting them and sending them in the mail. And they're like, great. So we spray painted them. And then once we knew that people liked it, then we started mass producing them, but we've sent out, I mean, between 5,000 and 6,000, maybe more than that. And it's different. I mean, I think that's, I'm not going to say like growth hack an organic landing page and get more key. Like that's,
yeah,
you can talk to somebody that does organic search, right? Like Mitch Causey at Demandwell. I'll give him a shout right now, but it's mostly the surprise and delight. Can you do something that's different? And sometimes it's going to fail. We did a direct mail campaign for Zendesk that was a Zen garden. Zendesk is a big partner of ours, and it failed miserably because nobody wanted to take them away at the trade show because they weighed like five. Like, who wants to put a 5-pound Zen garden in their suitcase? And then it was too expensive to ship. And eventually we had to figure out how to give them away and then throw away the rest of them because nobody wanted them. And then the board game worked really well. And we had a sales board game, we had a customer service board game, and we had a, you know, like a talent board game, and people love that. So for us, it has been direct mail, because direct mail is, I know that direct mail has been delivered to the person I want to receive it. And that's what's so valuable about it. As long as you have a team that can deliver creatively, you send out another water bottle, it's not going to work.
That's really great advice. One thing that I think we all sort of fall victim to is assuming that something is done, right, or over. And I think what happens is, as the market shifts and as it moved into cold calling and then email and now, you know, social media messaging and things like that, the things that become left behind, to your point, almost become new again, right?
Absolutely. Well, and they're different. I mean, and now you have software like Postal where your entire team can do this at scale and you're just paying a vendor to do it, right?
Right.
So this is another tactic, but we were doing 16 dinners a quarter in territory for AEs and maybe getting 40%, 50% show up. We're doing wine tasting and whiskey tasting and cooking classes now. We're getting like 90% of the people showing up. I'm never going to do a dinner in New York City again.
Yeah.
Like, why? Like, yeah. Why would I, when I can get everybody in the room still and they're having fun and they're not stressed out that they have to get home to make sure they see their kids before they go to bed or whatever you're doing, right? So, but you have to make it experience driven. Like, it can't be just another wine tasting because everybody's doing that now, right? So for us, it's how do you use the things that work and just evolve them in a way that's different.
So shifting gears away from work for a second, we know that you also have your own podcast where you talk about everything other than work.
Yes.
And so we're very interested to hear, do you have a favorite question that you like to talk to people about that is completely unwork related?
My go-to question on the podcast is, what's a defining moment in your life that shaped your identity? And
Not your work identity.
That's not your work identity. You know, what's fascinating is that people, I think maybe it's just because I tell them you can't talk about work, so maybe they don't go that direction, but nobody has actually went that direction. And we're in the, I just recorded like the 57th episode, I think. But yeah, that's my favorite question because I do quite a bit of research on the guests, but some people don't use social media. They're probably healthier because of it. and so when you can't find out about people, that's usually the best question to ask first, because it usually unpacks a lot that you didn't know about that person.
So we started by asking about your professional identity, but now, given that it's your favorite question, Kyle, what is the most defining moment that has impacted your non-work identity?
Oh, I knew that you were going to do that.
we weren't right slick. We didn't hide that one well enough.
Yeah, and I don't send questions ahead of time, so that's good too. So you caught me off guard, which is what I do to everybody else. So that's fair. You know, for me, there is two, and one is like quasi work, and I'm sorry that I'm going to do this, my kids being born. And I know that's not, some people say that, a lot of people say that, but for me, it kind of goes into the second one. But for me, I am so independent as an individual, and I've had to spend a lot of time dealing with just the ego side of my life and my business, that having children completely just blew that away. And it has been impactful both in a good and bad way. For those of you listening that have children, you understand that it's very difficult. It's rewarding at the same time. So, you know, that's the first one. The second one is moving to Boston. I think that helped me both professionally and personally to believe in my ability to do whatever the hell I wanted to do, because I went to a tier one city and my wife and I loved it and we survived it and I enjoyed working there and we would move back if we could. Right. And so that was probably the second, was spending time in Boston and realizing that we're all in the same boat. Doesn't matter where you live. Doesn't matter what job you have. You're all trying to figure it out. So those were the two, those were the two for me.
That's great. And thank you for sharing. We really appreciate that.
Yeah.
So what resources would you want to share with the audience in addition to Give and Take, which we already jotted down, but are there any other resources, books, blogs, podcasts, anything else that has been, you know, beneficial to you, again, work-wise, professional-wise, whatever that means to you?
Oh man. Yes. A lot. So from a book perspective, I usually read history. Like I'm not a huge, like the Adam Grant book is rare for me. You know, if you're into military history, just shoot me a tweet or whatever, because we could talk all day long about that. So right now I'm reading a book called Lessons from the Hanoi Hilton, which is a leadership book about, I think James Stockdale, I think, who was a POW in the Vietnam War, and the way that they built their leadership structures, POWs, like there's a lot of stoicism in there. Like it is just a great book. I highly recommend that. I also, you know, from a personal perspective, I love any books by, I'm probably going to butcher his name because I've never actually said it out loud, but Milan Kundera, Unbearable Lightness of Being, a lot of those books. I think they're very introspective. And then I love First Round, reading First Round's newsletter. I love reading Open View's newsletter, which comes every Saturday. Let's see what else. LinkedIn. I read LinkedIn way too much, but that's a... For me, I don't really consume a ton of books. It's mostly just the feed, which I'm usually reading about World War II or Civil War.
That's great. And then before we let you go, where can people find you on social media? Where can they tweet at you about military history?
you can find me on Twitter, Kyle P. Lacey, on LinkedIn. And I have an account on TikTok.
Uh-oh.
But I wouldn't recommend it.
that's the advanced move.
It makes me feel really old, but yeah, you can also find me on TikTok.
Fantastic. Well, Kyle, thank you so much for being here. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It was a blast.
Absolutely. Thanks, Kyle. Well, that was a great conversation with Kyle. Even as a data guy, I fully support his plan to take a portion of the marketing budget and intentionally not measure its impact on the business. And now it's time for Footnotes with Sophia.
Footnotes is where we expand on portions of the discussion that we wanted to learn more about and share with you. So for this week's footnotes, I wanted to talk about mental health. So there are plenty of different directions I could go with this, but after revisiting the Lessonly website, I'm fascinated by the phenomenal way their values seem to be integrated in everything they do. This goes for mental health as well. So specifically on Lessonly's website, they state better work starts with people. We're humans first and llamas second. So I generally really enjoy when companies share values that are not explicitly related to their product, but have still become a priority in the company culture and approach. So me being me, companies that prioritize mental health specifically stand out. And I note this because I think it's the first step in addressing anything, and making it known as a value is doing so from the top down.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. Coming from the top down, in my experience, is really the only way I've seen anything be effective. And from a messaging perspective, that's one thing, but then you also want to actually see it in action. And so as an example, something that I know I personally struggle with is how to disconnect from work, especially on weekends and holidays and at night and things like that. But I want to make sure I'm setting the right example that's not an expectation for the rest of the team. And I've seen that happen all the time where it's one thing to say it, but it's another to actually see it. And if you can see it starting from the leadership and starting from the top, then you can actually find it and it will actually permeate the culture of the organization.
Yeah, walk the walk, not just talking the talk, and especially not talking it just for the sake of saying it, right? Then it's just empty values.
Exactly.
So I wanted to use this time and this platform to distill some mental health related stats that will hopefully convince you, if you're not already convinced, how crucial it is to at least be aware, if not start talking about mental health with your teams. So one thing that really stood out to me was over 200 million workdays are lost due to mental health conditions each year. And to translate this into profit, $16.8 billion in productivity is what's equivalent to those workdays that were lost.
That's an amazing stat. And frankly, again, I believe that only includes things that are already known. And so that doesn't even include lost productivity and things that maybe weren't identified in the moment that way. I think, you know, we have a society and a norm where it's just sort of pushed through, and especially when it comes to work, that these things, you know, more traditionally going back a couple of years is a little more taboo to be part of it. And it's seen sort of as a sign of weakness. And so, yeah, I think it's important to look at the sort of the hard numbers of what we're actually losing today.
Yeah. And for context further, that stat was from 2019, so pre-pandemic. So I can only imagine what the numbers are now and the consequences of not more effectively addressing this among your employees.
Yeah. And one thing, I'm somebody who generally tries to see the bright side in things. And one of the silver linings of the pandemic was going to be around this, and that it's helped to some extent, and I'm sure it's caused a bit of discomfort, but helping people get sort of a grasp on their own, you know, mental health, and hopefully within organizations, just recognizing the sheer importance of it, where it was one of those things that I feel like, and again, this is my perspective, but maybe until the pandemic, it still hadn't totally reached that point of being completely acceptable to be a conversational topic sort of amongst any two people at work. And I think that the pandemic has hopefully helped made it more of a safe space.
Well, so I'm not sure if this was actually pre or in the midst of the pandemic, but there is a stat that I have relating to that as well. So if you're wondering whether your employees want mental health to be prioritized, wonder no further. 86% of respondents in a survey done by Mindshare partners SAP and Qualtrics found that companies' culture should support mental health. So this percentage was even higher for millennials and Gen Zers, who are now the largest demographic in the workforce and have the highest turnover rates.
And again, you can see those go hand in hand. I imagine that, look, like I'm fortunate. I consider myself fortunate to now see that a lot of good is coming from, you know, sort of the younger generations in the workforce. And hopefully things like this, and they will, and they already are starting to get kind of pushed from the bottom up. But seeing that, you know, and again, there's a lot of stats around millennials and Gen Z wanting to work more in terms of purpose and being more mindful of their mental health and taking more stock of that. And, you know, the truth is, again, back to, you know, when I was younger in my professional career, that the only two things that really mattered was, you know, how much you got paid and your job title, right? Like those are the only things that it really sort of crossed your mind when you were considering whether this was the right career move. And I think, again, as we're seeing in time, that it's a lot more multidimensional than that. And, you know, what the relationships you have and how your work and the work you do and the people you work with and how it makes you feel at the end of the day, which, again, I think is why some of the purpose-driven stuff is so important, where if you have that North Star as a company, and that doesn't necessarily mean you have to be a nonprofit or a charity, but just having a mission that you're working towards and having people bought in and have a culture that really leads with those values, I think it makes a ton of sense.
Yeah, and that's why I wanted to start this conversation, grounding it in the work that Lesson Lee does and the culture they've developed, because mental health is something they note, but it is not related to the actual thing that they are selling with their company. And so to tie off this series of stats with a intersectional ribbon, because that's how any conversation should be regarded, it's also important to note that half of the millennials and 75% of the Gen Zers in the study that I just mentioned had left previous roles in the past for mental health as opposed to 34% of the respondents overall, which speaks to the generational shift in awareness, as Jeff previously brought up. And then this is further compounded by other intersectional factors like race, for example, where almost half of Black and Latinx respondents had left a job at least partially for mental health reasons, compared to only 32% of Caucasian respondents.
I mean, staggering, but shouldn't be that surprising. And you know, for myself, I can say that it's the awareness and trying to have context for where everybody is in their lives and all of the things they're dealing with. And, you know, something I've had to try to figure out through my own, you know, corporate life is, you know, sort of what perspective might I have as a white male in society and in corporate America that somebody else might not have based on their perspective on it. And so, again, I think it's, you know, as always, it's leading with empathy, understanding that there's a lot more that's out of your purview. And I think, again, I think that applies more generally to mental health. And even if somebody is a little more, I don't want to call it old school, but a little less understanding of mental health as a serious issue, but understanding that if it is for your employees, then to take it more seriously. And so, of course, I think that bleeds into all of the intersectionality you're talking about as well.
Yeah, I think the main thing is just being open to the discussion, even if you aren't leading it. Leading the culture of open-mindedness is a step in the right direction.
Yeah. And just one thing to note, you know, one of our recent episodes with Beatrice, she talked about that, you know, we're all humans and that doesn't necessarily mean that we won't make mistakes. In fact, we will, right? But it's about being open, I think, to the conversation, being willing to dive in and trying to meet people where they are, I think is the best first step. But I don't think the answer is to wait until you feel that you have the perfect right thing to say or the process within the company. I don't think that'll ever exist. So I think to your point, it's leading with the empathy and being open to the conversation and truly listening is to me are the biggest things that anybody can be doing. Well, thank you, Sophia. And as always, all of the research and references can be found in the show notes. If you want to reach out to us directly about this story or inquire about sharing your own story, you can reach us at lsspodcast@circanresearch.com. Thank you for listening, and we hope you'll join us for a new story next week on Long Story Short. I want to thank Circan Research for being the sponsor of our show. Circan Research fuels demand for B2B marketers looking to gain a competitive advantage. We leverage original research and data-driven content to supercharge your growth. You can find out more on our website at circanresearch.com.